This is Audible.
HarperCollins and Harper Audio present Fallen, a novel by Karen Slaughter, performed by Kathleen Early. Introduction. I was delighted to be asked to write introductions for the first four Will Trent novels. While many of my characters are created organically, in response to a story or theme I'm trying to explore, I wrote Will with very deliberate intentions, from his first introduction early on in Triptych, to his partnering with Faith Mitchell in Fractured, to being pulled into Sarah Linton's orbit in Genesis and deeper still in Broken. Every step Will took, every thought he had was part of a plan that was first created inside the Grant County world. Unlike Sarah or Jeffrey or even my standalone characters, Will was not created for a story. Will was the story. It's difficult to talk about the origins of Will Trent without revealing some massive spoilers about the Grant County series, if not actual plot points, then character arcs. So, reader, consider this a warning that I'm going to have an open and honest conversation about why I decided to stop writing about Grant County and why I created Will Trent. That is, as open and honest as you can expect from someone who has, for the last 17 years, made a living by telling stories. When I created Sarah, Jeffrey, and Lena in Grant County, I was fulfilling the old writer's edict that you should write what you know. I grew up in a small town, and from an early age, I understood intrinsically how small towns operated. In fact, small towns are universal whether they're in South Georgia, or the south of France, or South Friesland. There's always the same cast of characters, the rich families, the poor folk, the trashy people, the loose women, the hypocrites, and the criminals. To have something shockingly bad happen, like a murder or a serial rapist or a pedophile stalking children, in a seemingly normal, everyday setting, was part of my overall goal to hold a mirror up to not just small-town society, but society as a whole. Crimes feel more real, more personal, and more violent when they happen in small towns. While I enjoyed writing about something I knew, small towns, I think a writer's purpose should also be to write about what they want to know. And I want to know why and how violence changes victims, families, investigators, and communities. I suppose this curiosity came from growing up in Georgia during a particularly violent time in American life, no more so than in Atlanta, where a serial killer was abducting and murdering children from 1979 until 1981. While I lived about 40 minutes away from where these crimes were happening, I was very aware that my daily existence had changed in very real ways in response to these brutal serial murders. I no longer could ride my bike on certain streets. I was forced to check in with my parents throughout the day, and even at night on television, there was no respite. Commercials were constantly announcing the time on the half hour and asking viewers, "Do you know where your children are?" Some of my earliest recollections of telling stories come from this time period. I remember quite clearly waking up in the middle of the night, sneaking into my older sister's room, holding a flashlight under my chin and whispering, "Who's killing the children?" She would start screaming. I would get scared by her screaming and start screaming myself, and then I would start crying, and then my parents would come in and punish my sister for making me so upset. Anyone who has a sibling will understand this dynamic. It's never the baby's fault. Thus, you could say from a very early age, I was encouraged to tell stories that scare people. It was this love of fear-mongering that brought me to writing crime fiction, and more specifically, writing Sarah Linton. If there was any one thing that took me down the road to Grant County, it was Sarah. She's basically everything I am not. Tall, red-headed, a medical doctor, and a bossy older sister. What we have in common is the desire to understand why people do the horrible things they do. Sarah is in a unique position to study possible answers to this question. As a pediatrician, she sees the potential of life walk through her door every single day. As a medical examiner, she witnesses firsthand the destruction wrought by violent death. I've spent the last 17 years writing about Sarah and other strong women, and one dynamic has not changed. It's incredibly difficult to write about an accomplished, smart woman without people hating her. As a society, we're wired to celebrate those characteristics in men, but we're incredibly suspect and critical of women who share the same qualities. To make Sarah feel less like a superhero and more like a woman you'd meet in the grocery store, I allowed her to make mistakes. Sometimes big mistakes that led to the bad guys, temporarily, getting away. I gave her a domineering mother and a baby sister who's always there to call her on her shit. Sarah's father loves her, but he also recognizes her faults. Lena Adams can't stand her, but that's mostly because Sarah thinks that Lena is too emotionally driven and dangerous to be trusted with Jeffrey Tolliver's life. To this day, not many give Sarah credit for being right. I remember quite clearly where I was when I decided that Jeffrey would die. I had just finished writing A Faint Cold Fear, the third Grant County novel, and it was one of those situations where my lizard brain figured out something important before my conscious brain did. I felt really hot and shaky, like I was getting the flu, and after a few hours of this, it came to me as a fully formed idea. Jeffrey had to die. I've always been the type of writer who thinks a few books ahead of the one I'm working on. Even if I don't have a firm plot, I know where the characters are going. At that point, in writing the Grant County series, I could clearly see the trajectory of Jeffrey and Sarah's relationship, and it was heading toward a happy ending. Reader, you think you want stories about people being happy, but you really don't. Happy people are boring. Either they have to keep fighting and breaking up, or they have to cheat on each other, or something awful has to happen to keep them interesting. After all they had been through, I couldn't see Jeffrey and Sarah choosing any of these false paths. Perhaps, more importantly, I did not want to end up being the Jessica Fletcher of Grant County. I mean, come on, why would anyone live in this incredibly violent, dangerous town? If I were to set stories in a large city, say, Atlanta, or write about a state cop rather than a small-town chief of police, wouldn't that open up my opportunities to kill people in new and exciting places? There were three more novels to come in the Grant County series, so I had a chance to plot out exactly how Jeffrey would die. By the time I wrote Faithless, I had started planting clues in the plots that would indicate to the careful reader the danger lurking ahead. Before writing the last novel in the series, I wrote a book I called A Standalone about a new character named Will Trent. I say that I called it a standalone because only my editor, my agent, and I knew that it was not. A lot of times authors are asked how long it takes to write a book. To me, it's not the writing that takes the most time, it's thinking about the characters. Will Trent was a character I thought about for 3 years. I liken his formation to a grain of sand turning into a pearl inside the oyster shell of my mind. I didn't want to just write another Jeffrey and set him in Atlanta. I wanted to think about Will as a fully formed man. What are his values? What kind of cop is he? What kind of man is he? Who are his friends? What is his situation like at work? Unlike Jeffrey, who was raised by an alcoholic mother and a convict father, Will grew up in state care, where he suffered a tremendous amount of abuse. I feel like this early exposure to violence made Will very wary of physical altercations, and in fact afraid of what violence can unleash inside of him. While Jeffrey was not afraid to slap around a suspect, Will is more likely to talk to them. Jeffrey, a former college athlete, is extremely self-confident in his body. Will, on the other hand, feels a sense of shame because of the scars on his body, as well as his dyslexia. If anything, Will understands criminals better than Jeffrey because he knows what it's like to try to hide something from the rest of the world. To me, the biggest difference between the two men is how they each responded the first time they met Sarah Linton. Jeffrey saw another beautiful woman to conquer. Will saw a smart, attractive doctor who was completely out of his league. Every character has a deep, dark secret. In fact, both Will and Sarah have some events in their pasts that readers don't yet know about, and might not ever know. Will is a man who is constantly struggling against his past. He's well aware of the statistics. Young men who grew up in state care have a more than 60% chance of ending up in prison later in life. I think Will's brush with the wrong side of the law was a wake-up call for him. The fact that Amanda Wagner, whose involvement in Will's life is a slowly unwrapped mystery, has been the great Oz behind the curtain is only part of the story. Will is stubborn and has a long history of agreeing with the women in his life, then doing whatever the hell he wants, but I think his moral compass, his desire to be a good person, is the reason why readers continue to root for him. If there is one defining trait that Will shares with Jeffrey, it is that each man experienced a moment in his life where he had to make a decision between letting his past dictate his future or dictating his future for himself. Jeffrey chose to stop being a cheating carouser and become the sort of man who deserves to be with Sarah. Will chose to be a good man because the only other option was being the kind of man Angie Pulaski admired. As with Jeffrey, Will's act of self-determination is fundamental to who he is as a man, as a cop, as a partner and friend, and as the person with whom Sarah Linton eventually falls in love. Saturday. Chapter 1. Faith Mitchell dumped the contents of her purse onto the passenger seat of her Mini, trying to find something to eat. Except for a furry piece of gum and a peanut of dubious origin, there was nothing remotely edible. She thought about the box of nutrition bars in her kitchen pantry, and her stomach made a noise that sounded like a rusty hinge groaning open. The computer seminar she'd attended this morning was supposed to last 3 hours, but that had stretched into 4.5 thanks to the jackass in the front row who kept asking pointless questions. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation trained its agents more often than any other agency in the region. Statistics and data on criminal activities were constantly being drummed into their heads. They had to be up to date on all of the latest technology. They had to qualify at the range twice a year. They ran mock raids and active shooter simulations that were so intense that for weeks after, Faith couldn't go to the bathroom in the middle of the night without checking shadows and doorways. Usually, she appreciated the agency's thoroughness. Today, all she could think about was her 4-month-old baby and the promise Faith had made to her mother that she would be back no later than noon. The clock on the dash read 10 after 1 o'clock when she started the car. Faith mumbled a curse as she pulled out of the parking lot in front of the Panthersville Road headquarters. She used Bluetooth to dial her mother's number. The car speakers gave back a staticky silence. Faith hung up and dialed again. This time, she got a busy signal. Faith tapped her finger on the steering wheel as she listened to the bleeding. Her mother had voicemail. Everybody had voicemail. Faith couldn't remember the last time she'd heard a busy signal on the telephone. She had almost forgotten the sound. There was probably a crossed wire somewhere at the phone company. She hung up and tried the number a third time. Still busy. Faith steered with one hand as she checked her BlackBerry for an email from her mother. Before Evelyn Mitchell retired, she had been a cop for just shy of 4 decades. You could say a lot about the Atlanta force, but you couldn't claim they were behind the times. Evelyn had carried a cell phone back when they were more like purses you strapped around your shoulder. She'd learned how to use email before her daughter had. She'd carried a BlackBerry for almost 12 years. But she hadn't sent a message today. Faith checked her cell phone voicemail. She had a saved message from her dentist's office about making an appointment to get her teeth cleaned, but there was nothing new. She tried her phone at home, thinking maybe her mother had gone there to pick up something for the baby. Faith's house was just down the road from Evelyn's. Maybe Emma had run out of diapers. Maybe she'd needed another bottle. Faith listened to the phone ring at her house, then heard her own voice answer, telling callers to leave a message. She ended the call. Without thinking, she glanced into the back seat. Emma's empty car seat was there. She could see the pink liner sticking out over the top of the plastic. "Idiot," Faith whispered to herself. She dialed her mother's cell phone number. She held her breath as she counted through 3 rings. Evelyn's voicemail picked up. Faith had to clear her throat before she could speak. She was aware of a tremor in her tone. "Mom, I'm on my way home. I guess you took Em for a walk." Faith looked up at the sky as she merged onto the interstate. She was about 20 minutes outside of Atlanta and could see fluffy white clouds draped like scarves around the skinny necks of skyscrapers. "Just call me," Faith said, worry needling the edge of her brain. Grocery store, gas station, pharmacy. Her mother had a car seat identical to the one in the back of Faith's Mini. She was probably out running errands. Faith was over an hour late. Evelyn would have taken the baby and left Faith a message that she was going to be out. The woman had been on call for the majority of her adult life. She didn't go to the toilet without letting someone know. Faith and her older brother Zeke had joked about it when they were kids. They always knew where their mother was, even when they didn't want to. Especially when they didn't want to. Faith stared at the phone in her hand as if it could tell her what was going on. She was aware that she might be letting herself get worked up over nothing. The landline could be out. Her mother wouldn't know this unless she tried to make a call. Her cell phone could be switched off, or charging, or both. Her BlackBerry could be in her car, or her purse, or somewhere she couldn't hear the telltale vibration. Faith glanced back and forth between the road and her BlackBerry as she typed an email to her mother. She spoke the words aloud as she typed. "On my way. Sorry I'm late. Call me." She sent the email, then tossed the phone onto the seat along with the spilled items from her purse. After a moment's hesitation, Faith popped the gum into her mouth. She chewed as she drove, ignoring the purse lint clinging to her tongue. She turned on the radio, then snapped it back off. The traffic thinned as she got closer to the city. The clouds moved apart, sending down bright rays of sunshine. The inside of the car began to bake. 10 minutes out, Faith's nerves were still on edge, and she was sweating from the heat in the car. She cracked the sunroof to let in some air. This was probably a simple case of separation anxiety. She'd been back at work for a little over 2 months, but still, every morning when Faith left Emma at her mother's, she felt something akin to a seizure take hold. Her vision blurred. Her heart shook in her chest. Her head buzzed as if a million bees had flown into her ears. She was more irritable than usual at work, especially with her partner, Will Trent, who either had the patience of Job or was setting up a believable alibi for when he finally snapped and strangled her. Faith couldn't recall if she had felt this same anxiety with Jeremy, her son, who was now a freshman in college. Faith had been 18 when she entered the police academy. Jeremy was 3 years old by then. She had grabbed onto the idea of joining the force as if it was the only life preserver left on the Titanic. Thanks to 2 minutes of poor judgment in the back of a movie theater, and what foreshadowed a lifetime of breathtakingly bad taste in men, Faith had gone straight from puberty to motherhood without any of the usual stops in between. At 18, she had relished the idea of earning a steady paycheck so that she could move out of her parents' house and raise Jeremy the way she wanted. Going to work every day had been a step toward independence. Leaving him in daycare had seemed like a small price to pay. Now that Faith was 34 with a mortgage, a car payment, and another baby to raise on her own, she wanted nothing more than to move back into her mother's house so that Evelyn could take care of everything. She wanted to open the refrigerator and see food that she didn't have to buy. She wanted to turn on the air conditioner in the summer without worrying about having to pay the bill. She wanted to sleep until noon, then watch TV all day. Hell, while she was at it, she might as well resurrect her father, who died 11 years ago, so that he could make her pancakes at breakfast and tell her how pretty she was. No chance of that now. Evelyn seemed happy to play the role of nanny in her retirement, but Faith was under no illusion that her life was going to get any easier. Her own retirement was almost 20 years away. The Mini had another 3 years of payments and would be out of warranty well before that. Emma would expect food and clothing for at least the next 18 years, if not more. And it wasn't like when Jeremy was a baby and Faith could dress him in mismatched socks and yard sale hand-me-downs. Babies today had to coordinate. They needed BPA-free bottles and certified organic applesauce from kindly Amish farmers. If Jeremy got into the architectural program at Georgia Tech, Faith was looking at 6 more years of buying books and doing his laundry. Most worryingly, her son had found a serious girlfriend. An older girlfriend, with curvy hips and a ticking biological clock. Faith could be a grandmother before she turned 35. An unwelcome heat rushed through her body as she tried to push this last thought from her mind. She checked the contents of her purse again as she drove. The gum hadn't made a dent. Her stomach was still growling. She reached over and felt around inside the glove box. Nothing. She should stop at a fast food place and at least get a Coke, but she was wearing her regs. Tan khakis and a blue shirt with letters GBI emblazoned in bright yellow on the back. This wasn't the best part of town to be in if you were law enforcement. People tended to run, and then you had to chase them, which wasn't conducive to getting home at a reasonable hour. Besides, something was telling her, urging her to see her mother. Faith picked up her phone and dialed Evelyn's numbers again. Home, cell, even her BlackBerry, which she only used for email. All three brought the same negative response. Faith could feel her stomach flip as the worst scenarios ran through her mind. As a beat cop, she'd been called out onto a lot of scenes where a crying child had alerted the neighbors to a serious problem. Mothers had slipped in the tub. Fathers had accidentally injured themselves or gone into coronary arrest. The babies had lain there, wailing helplessly, until someone had figured out that something was wrong. There was nothing more heart-wrenching than a crying baby who could not be soothed. Faith chided herself for bringing these horrible images to mind. She had always been good at assuming the worst, even before she became a cop. Evelyn was probably fine. Emma's nap time was at 1:30. Her mother had probably turned off the phone so the ringing wouldn't wake the baby. Maybe she'd run into a neighbor while checking the mailbox or gone next door to help old Mrs. Levy take out the trash. Still, Faith's hand slipped on the wheel as she exited onto Boulevard. She was sweating despite the mild March weather. This couldn't just be about the baby, or her mother, or even Jeremy's unconscionably fertile girlfriend. Faith had been diagnosed with diabetes less than a year ago. She was religious about measuring her blood sugar, eating the right things, making sure she had snacks on hand. Except for today. That probably explained why her thinking had gone sideways. She just needed to eat something, preferably in view of her mother and child. Faith checked the glove box again to make sure it was really empty. She had a distant memory of giving Will her last nutrition bar yesterday while they were waiting outside the courthouse. It was that, or watch him inhale a sticky bun from the vending machine. He had complained about the taste, but eaten the whole bar anyway. And now she was paying for it. She blew through a yellow light, speeding as much as she dared down a semi-residential street. The road narrowed at Ponce de Leon. Faith passed a row of fast food restaurants and an organic grocery store. She edged up the speedometer, accelerating into the twists and turns bordering Piedmont Park. The flash of a traffic camera bounced off her rearview mirror as she sailed through another yellow light. She tapped on the brakes for a straggling jaywalker. Two more grocery stores blurred by, then came the final red light, which was mercifully green. Evelyn still lived in the same house Faith and her older brother had grown up in. The single-story ranch was located in an area of Atlanta called Sherwood Forest, which was nestled between Ansley Park, one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city, and Interstate 85, which offered the constant roar of traffic, depending on which way the wind was blowing. The wind was blowing just fine today, and when Faith rolled down her window to let in more fresh air, she heard the familiar drone that had marked most every day of her childhood. As a lifelong resident of Sherwood Forest, Faith had a deep-seated hatred for the men who had planned the neighborhood. The subdivision had been developed after World War II, the brick ranch houses filled by returning soldiers who took advantage of low VA loans. The street planners had unabashedly embraced the Sherwood concept. After taking a hard left onto Lionel, Faith crossed Friar Tuck, took a right on Robin Hood Road, coasted through the fork at Lady Marion Lane, and checked the driveway of her own house on the corner of Doncaster and Barnesdale before finally pulling into her mother's driveway off Little John Trail. Evelyn's beige Chevy Malibu was backed into the carport. That, at least, was normal. Faith had never seen her mother pull nose first into a parking space. It came from her days in uniform. You always made sure your car was ready to leave as soon as a call came in. Faith didn't have time to reflect on her mother's routines. She rolled into the driveway and parked the Mini nose to nose with the Malibu. Her legs ached as she stood. Every muscle in her body had been tensed for the last 20 minutes. She could hear loud music blaring from the house. Heavy metal. Not her mother's usual Beatles. Faith put her hand on the hood of the Malibu as she walked toward the kitchen door. The engine was cold. Maybe Evelyn had been in the shower when Faith called. Maybe she hadn't checked her email or cell phone. Maybe she had cut herself. There was a bloody handprint on the door. Faith felt herself do a double take. The bloody print showed a left hand. It was about 18 inches above the knob. The door had been pulled closed but hadn't latched. A streak of sunlight cut through the jam, probably from the window over the kitchen sink. Faith still couldn't process what she was seeing. She held up her own hand to the print, a child pressing her fingers to her mother's. Evelyn's hand was smaller, slender fingers. The tip of her ring finger hadn't touched the door. There was a clot of blood where it should have been. Suddenly the music stopped mid-thump. In the silence, Faith heard a familiar gurgling noise, a revving up that announced the coming of a full-on wail. The sound echoed in the carport, so that for a moment, Faith thought it was coming from her own mouth. Then it came again, and she turned around, knowing that it was Emma. Almost every other house in Sherwood Forest had been razed or remodeled, but the Mitchell home was much the same as when it had first been built. The layout was simple: 3 bedrooms, a family room, a dining room, and a kitchen with a door leading to the open carport. Bill Mitchell, Faith's father, had built a tool shed on the opposite side of the carport. It was a sturdy building. Her father had never done anything halfway. With a metal door that bolted shut and safety glass in its one window. Faith was 10 before she realized that the building was too fortified for something as simple as tool storage. With the tenderness that only an older brother can muster, Zeke had filled her in on the shed's true purpose. "It's where Mom keeps her gun, you dumbass." Faith ran past the car and tried to open the shed door. It was locked. She looked through the window. The metal wires and the safety glass formed a spiderweb in front of her eyes. She could see the potting table and bags of soil stacked neatly underneath. Tools hung on their proper hooks. Lawn equipment was stowed neatly in place. A black metal safe with a combination lock was bolted to the floor under the table. The door was open. Evelyn's cherry-handled Smith & Wesson revolver was missing. So was the carton of ammunition that was usually beside it. The gurgling noise came again, louder this time. A pile of blankets on the floor pulsed up and down like a heartbeat. Evelyn used them to cover her plants during unexpected freezes. They were usually folded on the top shelf, but now were wadded up in the corner beside the safe. Faith saw a tuft of pink sticking up behind the gray blankets, then the bend of a plastic headrest that could only be Emma's car seat. The blanket moved again. A tiny foot kicked out, a soft yellow cotton sock with white lace trim around the ankle. Then a little pink fist punched through. Then she saw Emma's face. Emma smiled at Faith, her top lip forming a soft triangle. She gurgled again, this time with delight. "Oh, God." Faith uselessly pulled at the locked door. Her hand shook as she felt around the top edge of the jamb trying to find the key. Dust rained down. The sharp point of a splinter dug into her finger. Faith looked in the window again. Emma clapped her hands together, soothed by the sight of her mother, despite the fact that Faith was as close to a full-on panic as she had ever been in her life. The shed was hot. It was too warm outside. Emma could overheat. She could become dehydrated. She could die. Terrified, Faith got down on her hands and knees, thinking the key had fallen, possibly slid back under the door. She saw that the bottom of Emma's car seat was bent where it had been wedged between the safe and the wall, hidden behind the blankets, blocked by the safe, protected by the safe. Faith stopped. Her lungs tightened mid-breath. Her jaw tensed as if it had been wired shut. Slowly, she sat up. There were drops of blood on the concrete in front of her. Her eyes followed the trail going to the kitchen door, to the bloody handprint. Emma was locked in the shed. Evelyn's gun was missing. There was a blood trail to the house. Faith stood facing the unlatched kitchen door. There was no sound but her own labored breath. Who had turned off the music? Faith jogged back to her car. She took her Glock from under the driver's seat. She checked the magazine and clipped the holster to her side. Her phone was still on the front seat. Faith grabbed it before popping open the trunk. She had been a detective with the Atlanta Homicide Squad before becoming a special agent with the state. Her fingers dialed the unlisted emergency line from memory. She didn't give the dispatcher time to speak. She rattled off her old badge number, her unit, and her mother's street address. Faith paused before saying, "Code 30. The words nearly choked her. Code 30. She had never used the phrase in her life. It meant that an officer needed emergency assistance. It meant that a fellow cop was in serious danger, possibly dead. "My child is locked in the shed outside. There's blood on the concrete and a bloody handprint on the kitchen door. I think my mother is inside the house. I heard music, but it was turned off. She's retired blue. I think she's..." Faith's throat tightened like a fist. "Help. Please. Send help."
"Acknowledge code 30, the dispatcher answered, her tone sharp and tense. "Stay outside and wait for backup. Do not, repeat, do not go into the house."
"Acknowledged." Faith ended the call and tossed the phone into the back seat. She twisted her key into the lock that kept her shotgun bolted to the trunk of her car. The GBI issued every agent at least two weapons. The Glock Model 23 was a .40 caliber semi-automatic that held 13 rounds in the magazine and one in the chamber. The Remington 870 held 4 rounds of double-aught buckshot in the tube. Faith's shotgun carried 6 extra rounds in the side saddle attached in front of the stock. Each round contained 8 pellets. Each pellet was about the size of a .38 caliber bullet. Every pull of the trigger on the Glock shot 1 bullet. Every pull on the Remington shot 8. Agency policy dictated that all agents keep a round chambered in their Glocks, giving them 14 rounds total. There was no conventional external safety on the weapon. Agents were authorized by law to use deadly force if they felt their lives or the lives of others were in danger. You only pulled back on the trigger when you meant to shoot, and you only shot when you meant to kill. The shotgun was a different story with the same ending. The safety was to the rear of the trigger guard, a crossbolt slide that took lithe muscle to move. You didn't keep around in the chamber. You wanted everybody around you to hear that round racking, setting up to blast. Faith had seen grown men drop to their knees at the sound. She looked back at the house as she disengaged the safety. The curtain on the front window twitched. A shadow ran down the hallway. Faith pumped the shotgun with one hand as she walked toward the carport. The action made a satisfying thunk that echoed against the concrete. In a single fluid motion, the stock was against her shoulder, the barrel straight in front of her. She kicked open the door, holding the weapon steady as she yelled, "Police!" The word boomed through the house like a clash of thunder. It came from a deep, dark place in Faith's gut that she ignored most of the time, for fear of switching something on that could never be shut off.
"Come out with your hands in the air!"
No one came out. She heard a noise from somewhere in the back of the house. Her vision sharpened as she entered the kitchen. Blood on the counter. A bread knife. More blood on the floor. Drawers and cabinets gaping open. The phone on the wall hung like a twisted noose. Evelyn's BlackBerry and cell phone were smashed to pieces on the floor. Faith kept the shotgun in front of her, finger resting just to the side of the trigger so that she didn't make any mistakes. She should have been thinking about her mother. Or Emma. But there was only one phrase that kept going through her mind. People and doorways. When you cleared a house, these were the biggest threats to your safety. You had to know where the people were, whether they were good guys or not, and you had to know what was coming at you from every door. Faith pivoted to the side, pointing the shotgun into the laundry room. She saw a man lying face down on the floor, black hair, skin a yellow wax. His arms wrapped around his body like a child playing a spinning game. No gun on or near him. The back of his head was a bloody pulp. Brain matter speckled the washing machine. She could see the hole the bullet dug into the wall when it exited his skull. Faith pivoted back to the kitchen. There was a pass-through to the dining room. She crouched and swung around. Empty. The layout of the house came to her like a diagram in her head. Family room on her left. Large, open foyer on the right. Hall straight ahead. Bathroom at the end. Two bedrooms on the right, one bedroom on the left. Her mother's room. Inside was a tiny bathroom, a door that led to the back patio. Evelyn's bedroom door was the only one in the hall that was closed. Faith started to go toward the closed door but stopped. People in doorways. Her mind saw the words engraved in stone. Do not proceed toward your downward threat until you are sure everything behind you is clear. Faith crouched as she turned left, entering the family room. She scanned along the walls, checked the sliding glass door that led into the backyard. The glass was shattered. A breeze rustled the curtains. The room had been ransacked. Someone was looking for something. Drawers were broken, cushions gutted. From her vantage point, Faith could see behind the couch that the wing-back chair was clear of extra feet. She kept her head swiveling back and forth between the room and the hall until she was sure she could move on. The first door was to her old bedroom. Someone had searched here, too. The drawers in Faith's old bureau stuck out like tongues. The mattress was ripped open. Emma's crib had been busted to pieces. Her blanket was ripped in two. The mobile that had hung above her head every month of her life had been ground into the carpet like a pile of dirt. Faith swallowed the burning rage this ignited inside of her. She forced herself to keep moving. Quickly, she cleared the closets under the bed. She did the same in Zeke's room, which had been turned into her mother's office. Papers were scattered on the floor. The desk drawers had been thrown against the wall. She glanced into the bathroom. The shower curtain was pulled back. The linen closet gaped open. Towels and sheets spilled onto the floor. Faith was standing to the left of her mother's bedroom door when she heard the first siren. It was distant, but clear. She should wait for it. Wait for backup. Faith kicked open the door and swung around in a crouch. Her finger went to the trigger. Two men were at the foot of the bed. One was on his knees. He was Hispanic, dressed only in a pair of jeans. The skin across his chest was shredded as if he'd been whipped with barbed wire. Sweat glistened on every part of his body. Black and red bruises punched along his ribs. He had tattoos all over his arms and torso, the largest of which was on his chest, a green and red Texas star with a rattlesnake wrapped around it. He was a member of Los Texicanos, a Mexican gang that had controlled the Atlanta drug trade for 20 years. The second man was Asian. No tattoos. Bright red Hawaiian shirt and tan chinos. He stood with the Texicano in front of him, holding a gun to the man's head. A cherry-handled Smith & Wesson five-shot, her mother's revolver. Faith kept the shotgun trained on the Asian's chest. The cold, hard metal felt like an extension of her body. Adrenaline had pumped her heart into a frenzy. Every muscle inside of her wanted to pull the trigger. Her words were clipped. "Where's my mother?" He spoke in a twangy southern drawl.
"You shoot me, you're gonna hit him."
He was right. Faith was standing in the hallway, less than 6 feet away. The men were too close together. Even a headshot carried the risk that a pellet would stray, hitting, possibly killing the hostage. Still, she kept her finger on the trigger, the shotgun steady. "Tell me where she is." He pressed the muzzle harder against the man's head.
"Drop the gun."
The sirens were getting louder. They were coming from Zone 5, on the peach tree side of the neighborhood. Faith said, "You hear that sound?" She mapped their path down Nottingham, calculating the cruisers would be here in less than a minute. "Tell me where my mother is, or I swear to God I'll kill you before they hit the door." He smiled again, his hand tightening around the gun.
"You know what we're here for. Hand it over and we'll let her go."
Faith didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Her mother was a 63-year-old widow. The most valuable thing in the house was the land they were standing on. He took her silence for equivocation.
"You really want to lose your mommy over Chico here." Faith pretended to understand. It's that simple? You'll trade?
He shrugged.
Only way we'll both walk out of here.
Bullshit.
No bullshit. Even trade.
The sirens got louder. Tires screeched in the street.
Come on, bitch. Tick-tock, deal or no deal.
He was lying. He'd already killed one person. He was threatening another. As soon as he figured out Faith was bluffing, the only thing he'd give her was a bullet in the chest.
Deal,
she agreed, using her left hand to toss the shotgun out in front of her. The firearms instructor at the shooting range carried a stopwatch that counted every tenth of a second, which was why Faith knew that it took her right hand exactly 8/10 of a second to draw her Glock from her side holster. While the Asian was distracted by her shotgun dropping at his feet, she did just this, pulling the Glock, snaking her finger around the trigger, and shooting the man in the head. His arms flew up. The gun dropped. He was dead before he hit the floor. The front door splintered open. Faith turned toward the foyer as an entry team in full raid gear flooded into the house, and then she turned back toward the bedroom and realized the Mexican was gone. The patio door was open. Faith ran outside as the Mexican vaulted over the chain-link fence. The S&W was in his hand. Mrs. Johnson's grandchildren were playing in her backyard. They screamed when they saw the armed man heading toward them. He was 20 feet away. 15. He raised the gun toward the girls and fired a shot over their heads. Brick siding sprayed onto the ground. They were too scared to scream anymore, to move, to save themselves. Faith stopped at the fence, lined up her Glock, and squeezed the trigger. The man jerked as if a string had been pulled through his chest. He stayed up for at least a full second, then his knees buckled and he fell backward onto the ground. Faith jumped over the fence and sprinted toward him. She slammed her heel into his wrist until he let go of her mother's gun. The girls started screaming again. Mrs. Johnson came out onto the porch and scooped them up like baby ducklings. She glanced back at Faith as she shut the door. The look in her eyes was shocked, horrified. She used to chase Zeke and Faith with the garden hose when they were little. She used to feel safe here. Faith holstered her Glock and tucked Evelyn's revolver into the back of her pants. She grabbed the Mexican by the shoulders.
Where's my mother? She demanded. What did they do to her?
He opened his mouth, blood oozing beneath the silver caps in his teeth. He was smiling. The asshole was smiling.
Where is she?
Faith pressed her hand to his battered chest, feeling his broken ribs move beneath her fingers. He screamed in pain, and she pushed harder, grinding the bones together.
Where is she?
Agent!
A young cop steadied himself with one hand as he jumped over the fence. He drew down on her, his gun angled toward the ground.
Back away from the prisoner!
Faith got closer to the Mexican. She could feel the heat radiating from his skin.
Tell me where she is.
His throat worked. He wasn't feeling the pain anymore. His pupils were the size of dimes. His eyelids fluttered. The corner of his lip twitched.
Tell me where she is.
Her voice got more desperate with each word.
Oh, God, just please tell me where she is.
His breath had a sticky sound, as if his lungs were taped together. His lips moved. He whispered something she couldn't make out.
What?
Faith put her ear so close to his lips that she could feel spit coming out of his mouth.
Tell me,
she whispered.
Please tell me.
Almeja.
What?
Faith repeated.
What did you say?
His mouth opened. Instead of words, blood pooled out.
What did you say?
She screamed.
Tell me what you said!
Agent,
the cop yelled again.
No.
She pressed her palms into the Mexican's chest, trying to force his heart to pump again. Faith made a fist and slammed it down as hard as she could, beating the man, willing him to come back to life.
Tell me!
She yelled.
Just tell me!
Agent.
She felt hands around her waist. The cop practically lifted her into the air.
Let me go!
Faith jammed her elbow back so hard that he dropped her like a stone. She scrambled across the grass, crawling to the witness, the hostage, the murderer. The only person left who could tell her what the hell had happened to her mother.
She put her hands to the Mexican's face, stared into his lifeless eyes.
Please tell me,
she pleaded, even though she knew it was too late.
Please.
Faith. Detective Leo Donnelly, her old partner on the Atlanta force, stood on the other side of the fence. He was out of breath. His hands gripped the top of the chain link. The wind whipped open the jacket of his cheap brown suit.
Emma's fine. We got a locksmith on the way.
His words came thick and slow, like molasses poured through a sieve.
Come on, kid. Emma needs her mom.
Faith looked behind him. Cops were everywhere. Dark blue uniforms blurred as they swept the house, checked the yard. Through the windows, she followed Tactical's progress from room to room, guns raised, voices calling clear as they found nothing. Competing sirens filled the air. Police cruisers, ambulances, a fire truck. The call had gone out. Code 30. Officer needs emergency assistance. 3 men shot to death. Her baby locked in a shed. Her mother missing. Faith sat back on her heels. She put her head in her shaking hands and willed herself not to cry. Chapter 2.
So, he tells me he was changing the oil in his car and it was hot in the garage, so he took off his pants.
Uh-huh, Sarah Linton managed, trying to feign interest as she picked at her salad.
And I say, look it, bud, I'm a doctor. I'm not here to judge. You can be honest about...
Sarah watched Dale Dugan's mouth move, his voice mercifully blending in with the lunchtime noise of the pizza parlor. Soft music playing, people laughing, plates sliding around the kitchen. His story was not particularly riveting or even new. Sarah was a pediatric attending doctor in the emergency department at Atlanta's Grady Hospital. She'd had her own practice for 12 years before that, all the while working part-time as the county coroner for a small but active college town. There was not an implement, tool, household product, or glass figurine she had not, at some point or another, seen lodged inside a human body. Still, Dale continued.
Then the nurse comes in with the x-ray.
Uh-oh, she said, trying to inject some curiosity into her tone. Dale smiled at her. There was some cheese lodged between his central and lateral incisors. Sarah tried not to judge. Dale Dugan was a nice man. He wasn't handsome, but he was okay looking, with the sort of features many women found attractive once they learned he'd graduated from medical school. Sarah was not as easily swayed. And she was starving, because she'd been told by the friend who'd set her up on this ridiculous blind date that she should order a salad instead of a pizza because it looked better.
So, I hold up the x-ray and what do I see?
Socket wrench, she thought, just before he finally reached the punchline.
A socket wrench! Can you believe it?
No! She forced a laugh that sounded like the sort of thing that came out of a wind-up toy.
And he still kept saying he slipped.
She tisked her tongue. Quite a fall.
I know, right?
He smiled at her again before taking a healthy bite of pizza. Sarah chewed some lettuce. The digital clock over Dale's head showed 2:12 and a handful of seconds. The red LED numbers were a painful reminder that she could be at home right now watching basketball and folding the mountain of laundry on her couch. Sarah had made a game of not looking at the clock, seeing how long she could go before her self-control crumbled and she watched the blurring seconds tick by. 3 minutes, 22 seconds was her record. She took another bite of salad, vowing to beat it.
So, Dale said. You went to Emory.
She nodded. You were at Duke? Predictably, he began what turned into a lengthy description of his academic achievements, including published journal articles and keynote speeches at various conferences. Again, Sarah feigned attention, willing herself not to look at the clock, chewing lettuce as slowly as a cow in a pasture, so that Dale would not feel compelled to ask her a question. This was not Sarah's first blind date, nor, unfortunately, was it her least tedious. The problem today had started within the first 6 minutes, which Sarah had marked by the clock. They had rushed through the preliminaries before their order had been called. Dale was divorced, no children, on good terms with his ex-wife, and played pickup basketball games at the hospital in his free time. Sarah was from a small town in South Georgia. She had two greyhounds and a cat who chose to live with her parents. Her husband had been killed 4.5 years ago. Usually, this last bit was a conversation stopper, but Dale had breezed over it as a minor detail. At first, Sarah had given him points for not asking for details, and then she had decided that he was too self-absorbed to ask, and then she had chided herself for being so hard on the man. "What did your husband do?" He'd caught her with a mouthful of lettuce. She chewed, swallowed, then told him. "He was a police officer, the chief of police for the county." "That's unusual." Her expression must have been off because he said, "I mean, unusual because he's not a doctor." "Wasn't a doctor. Not white collar, I guess." "White collar?" She heard the accusatory tone in her voice but couldn't stop herself. "My father's a plumber. My sister and I worked with him for..." "Whoa, whoa." He held up his hands in surrender. "That came out wrong. I mean, there's something noble about working with your hands, right?" Sarah didn't know what kind of medicine Dr. Dale was practicing, but she tended to use her hands every day. Oblivious, his voice took on a solemn tone. "I have a lot of respect for cops. And service people. Soldiers, I mean." He nervously wiped his mouth with his napkin. "Dangerous job. Is that how he died?" She nodded, glancing at the clock. 3:19. She just missed her record. He took his phone out of his pocket and looked at the display. "Sorry, I'm on call. I wanted to make sure there's service." At least he hadn't pretended the phone was on silent ring, though Sarah was sure that was coming. "I'm sorry for being so defensive. It's difficult to talk about." "I'm sorry for your loss." His tone had a practiced cadence Sarah recognized from the ER. "I'm sure it was hard." She bit at the tip of her tongue. Sarah couldn't think of a polite way to respond, and by the time she thought to change the subject to the weather, so much time had passed that the conversation felt even more awkward. Finally, she said, "Well, anyway, why don't we..." "Excuse me," he interrupted. "I need to go to the bathroom." He got up so quickly that his chair nearly fell over. Sarah watched him scamper toward the back. Maybe it was her imagination, but she thought he hesitated in front of the fire exit. Idiot. She dropped her fork onto her salad plate. She checked the clock again for the time. It was 2:15. She could wrap this up by 2:30 if Dale ever came back from the toilet. Sarah had walked here from her apartment, so there wouldn't be that protracted, awful silence as Dale drove her home. The bill had been paid when they ordered the food at the cash register. It would take her 15 minutes to walk home, giving her time to change out of her dress and into her sweatpants before the basketball game started. Sarah felt her stomach rumble. Maybe she could pretend to leave, then backtrack and order a pizza. Another minute ticked by on the clock. Sarah scanned the parking lot. Dale's car was still there, assuming the green Lexus with the Dr. Dale license plate belonged to him. She didn't know if she felt disappointed or relieved. The clock marked another 30 seconds. The hallway leading to the bathroom stayed empty for another 23 seconds. An older woman with a walker inched her way down the hall. No one was behind her. Sarah dropped her head into her hand. Dale was not a bad man. He was stable, relatively healthy, gainfully employed, had most of his hair, and, except for the cheese between his teeth, had the appearance of good hygiene. And yet, all of this wasn't enough. Sarah was beginning to think she was the problem. She was turning into the Mr. Darcy of Atlanta. Once her good opinion was lost, it was gone forever. Changing the direction of a steamship was easier than changing Sarah's mind. She should try harder at this. She wasn't 25 anymore, and 40 was breathing heavy down the back of her neck. At 5'11", her dating pool was already limited. Her auburn red hair and fair skin were not to every man's taste. She worked long hours. She couldn't cook to save her life.
She had apparently lost her ability to conduct any small talk whatsoever, and the mere mention of her dead husband could send her into a hissy fit. Maybe her standards were too high. Her marriage hadn't been perfect, but it was pretty damn good. She had loved her husband more than life itself. Losing him had almost killed her. But Jeffrey had been gone for almost 5 years now, and if Sarah was being honest, she was lonely. She missed a man's company. She missed the way their minds worked and the surprisingly sweet things they could say. She missed the rough feel of their skin. She missed the other things, too. Unfortunately, the last time a man had made her eyes roll back in her head, she'd been fighting boredom, not writhing in ecstasy. Sarah had to face the fact that she was extremely, awfully, horribly bad at dating. There hadn't been much time to practice. From puberty on, Sarah had been serially monogamous. Her first boyfriend was a high school crush that had lasted until college. Then she'd dated a fellow student all through medical school. Then she'd met Jeffrey, and never given another man a second thought. Except for a disastrous one-night stand 3 years ago, there had been no one since. She could only think of one man who had even remotely given her a spark, but he was married. Worse, he was a married cop. Even worse, he was standing at the cash register less than 10 feet away from her. Will Trent was wearing black running shorts and a long-sleeved black t-shirt that showed his broad shoulders to good advantage. His sandy blonde hair was longer than it had been a few months ago, when Sarah had last seen him. He'd been working a case that involved one of her older patients at the children's clinic back home. She'd stuck her nose so far into Will's business that he'd had no choice but to let her help with the investigation. They had shared what felt like a flirtation, and then, when the case was over, he had gone back home to his wife. Will was extremely observant. He must have noticed Sarah sitting at the table when he walked in. Still, he kept his back to her as he stared at a flyer pinned to the bulletin board on the wall. She didn't need the clock to count off the seconds as she waited for him to acknowledge her. He turned his attention to another flyer. Sarah pulled out the clip holding up her hair, letting the curls fall past her shoulders. She stood up and walked over to him. There were a few things she knew about Will Trent. He was tall, at least 6'3", with a runner's lean body and the most beautiful legs she had ever seen on a man. His mother had been killed when he was less than a year old. He'd grown up in a children's home and never been adopted. He was a special agent with the GBI. He was one of the smartest men she had ever met, and he was so dyslexic that, as far as she could tell, he read no higher than a second grade level. She stood shoulder to shoulder with him, staring at the flyer that had caught his attention. That looks interesting. He made a very bad show of acting surprised to see her. Dr. Linton, I was just... He tore one of the info tags off the flyer. I've been thinking about getting a bike. She glanced at the ad, which had a detailed drawing of a Harley Davidson underneath a headline asking for members to join. I don't think Dykes on Bikes is your kind of ride. His smile was crooked. He'd spent a lifetime covering up his disability, and even though Sarah had found out, he was still loath to acknowledge there was a problem. It's a great way to meet women. Are you looking to meet women? Sarah was reminded of yet another one of Will's traits, which was that he had an uncanny knack for keeping his mouth shut when he didn't know what to say. This resulted in the sort of awkward moments that made Sarah's dating life look downright ebullient. Thankfully, Will's order was up. Sarah stood back as he took the box of pizza from the tattooed and multi-pierced waitress. The young woman gave Will what could only be called an appreciative glance. He seemed oblivious as he checked his pizza to make sure they'd gotten the order right. Well, he used his thumb to twist the wedding ring on his finger. I guess I should go. All right. He didn't move. Neither did Sarah. A dog started barking outside, the high-pitched yips traveling through the open windows. Sarah knew there was a post and water bowl by the front door for people who brought their pets to the restaurant. She also knew that Will's wife had a little dog named Betty, and that the care and feeding fell mostly to him. The yipping intensified.
Will still made no move to leave. She said, "That sounds a lot like a chihuahua." He listened intently, then nodded. "I think you might be right."
"There you are." Dale was finally back from the restroom. "Listen, I got a call from the hospital."
He looked up at Will.
"Hi."
Sarah made the introductions. "Dale Dugan, this is Will Trent." Will gave a tight nod. Dale returned it. The dog kept barking, a piercing, panicked yelp. Sarah could tell from Will's expression that he was prepared to die rather than acknowledge ownership. She found some mercy in her heart. "Dale, I know you need to get to the hospital. Thanks so much for lunch."
"Sure."
He leaned in and kissed her squarely on the lips.
"I'll call you."
"Great," she managed, resisting the urge to wipe her mouth. She watched the two men exchange another tight nod that made Sarah feel like the only fire hydrant at the dog park. Betty's yips intensified as Dale walked across the parking lot. Will mumbled something under his breath before pushing open the door. He untied the leash and scooped up the dog with one hand, keeping the pizza box steadied in the other. The barking stopped immediately. Betty tucked her head into his chest. Her tongue lolled out. Sarah petted the dog's head. There were fresh sutures crisscrossing her narrow back. "What happened?" Will's jaw was still clenched.
"She got into it with a Jack Russell."
"Really?" Unless the Jack Russell had a pair of scissors for paws, there was no way another dog had made the marks. He indicated Betty.
"I should get her home."
Sarah had never been to Will's house, but she knew the street that he lived on. "Aren't you going right?" she clarified. "This way?" Will didn't answer. He seemed to be gauging whether or not he could lie to her and get away with it. She pressed. "Don't you live off Linwood?"
"You're the opposite direction."
"I can cut through the park." She started walking, giving him no choice. They were silent as they headed down Ponce de Leon. The traffic noise was loud enough to fill the void, but even the exhaust from the cars couldn't overshadow the fact that they were in the middle of a brilliant spring day. Couples walked down the street hand in hand. Mothers pushed baby carriages. Runners darted across four lanes of traffic. The cloud cover from this morning had rolled eastward, exposing a sky of denim blue. There was a steady breeze in the air. Sarah clasped her hands behind her back and looked down at the broken sidewalk. Tree roots pushed against the concrete like gnarled old toes. She glanced at Will. The sun picked out the sweat on his brow. There were two scars on his face, though Sarah had no idea what had caused them. His upper lip had been split open at some point, then badly stitched together, giving a raffish quality to his mouth. The other scar followed the line of his left jaw and dipped into his collar. When she'd first met him, she'd taken the scars for signs of boyhood mischief, but knowing his history, knowing that he had grown up in state care, Sarah now assumed the damage had a darker story. Will glanced at her and she looked away. He said,
"Dale seems like a nice guy."
"Yes, he does."
"Doctor, I guess."
"That's right."
"Look like a good kisser."
She smiled. Will shifted Betty in his hand to get a better grip.
"I guess you're dating him."
"Today was our first date."
"You seemed friendlier than that."
Sarah stopped walking. "How's your wife, Will?" His answer didn't come quickly. His gaze fell somewhere over her shoulder.
"I haven't seen her in 4 months."
Sarah felt an odd sense of betrayal. His wife was gone, and Will had not called her.
"You're separated?"
He stepped aside so that a runner could pass.
"No."
"Is she missing?"
"Not exactly."
A MARTA bus lurched up to the curb, its engine filling the air with a protracted grumble. Sarah had met Angie Trent almost a year ago. Her Mediterranean looks and curvaceous figure were exactly the sort of things mothers were thinking of when they warned their sons about loose women. The bus pulled away. Sarah asked, "Where is she?" Will let out a long breath.
"She leaves me a lot. That's what she does. She leaves, and then she comes back. And then she stays some, and then she leaves again."
"Where does she go?"
"I have no idea."
You've never asked her?
No.
Sarah didn't pretend to understand.
Why not?
He glanced out into the street, watching the traffic zoom by.
It's complicated.
She reached out and put her hand on his arm.
Explain it to me.
He stared at her, looking ridiculous with the tiny dog in one hand and a pizza box in the other. Sarah narrowed the space between them, moving her hand to his shoulder. She could feel hard muscle beneath his shirt, the heat from his skin. In the bright light of the sun, his eyes looked impossibly blue. He had delicate eyelashes, blonde and soft. There was a stubbly spot along his jaw that he'd missed shaving. She was a few inches shorter than him. She stood on her tiptoes to look him straight in the eye. She said, "Talk to me." He was silent, his eyes tracing back and forth across her face, lingering on her mouth, before meeting her gaze again. Finally, he said,
"I like your hair down."
Sarah was robbed of a response by a black SUV slamming on its brakes in the middle of the street. It skidded to a halt about 20 yards away, then jerked into reverse. The wheel squealed against the asphalt. The smell of burned rubber filled the air. The SUV stopped directly in front of them. The window rolled down. Will's boss, Amanda Wagner, yelled, "Get in!" They were both too stunned to move. Car horns blared. Fists were waving. Sarah felt like she was caught in the middle of an action movie.
"Now,"
Amanda ordered.
"Can you?"
Will began, but Sarah was already taking Betty, the box of pizza. He fished into a sock and handed her a house key.
"She needs to be locked in the spare room so she doesn't—"
"Will!"
Amanda's tone didn't leave room for equivocation. Sarah took the key. The metal was warm from his body.
"Go."
Will didn't have to be told twice. He jumped into the car, his foot skipping along the road as Amanda pulled away from the curb. More horns blared. A four-door sedan fishtailed. Sarah could see a teenager in the back seat, the girl's hands pressed against the window. Her mouth gaped open in terror. Another car was coming from behind, speeding but swerved at the last moment. Sarah locked eyes with the young girl, then the sedan straightened and drove away. Betty was shaking, and Sarah wasn't much better off. She tried to soothe the dog as she walked toward Will's street, holding it close, pressing her lips to its head. Both of their hearts were pounding wildly. Sarah wasn't sure what was making it worse. Thinking about what might have happened between her and Will, or the bad accident Amanda Wagner had nearly caused. She'd have to watch the news when she got home to find out what was going on. Surely, wherever Will was going, the news vans would follow. Amanda was a deputy director with the GBI. She didn't ride around looking for her agents on a whim. Sarah imagined Faith, Will's partner, was probably doing her own mad rush to the crime scene right now. She had forgotten to ask for his house number, but thankfully, Betty's caller had a tag with the details. Even without that, she easily spotted Will's black Porsche parked in a driveway toward the end of the street. The car was an older model that had been fully restored. Will must have washed it today. The tires were gleaming, and her reflection bounced off the long nose of the hood as she walked past. She smiled at his house, which she'd never seen before. He lived in a red brick bungalow with an attached garage. The front door was painted black. The trim was a buttery yellow. The lawn was well tended with sharp edges and sculpted shrubs. A colorful flower bed circled the mimosa tree in the front yard. Sarah wondered if Angie Trent had a green thumb. Pansies were hardy plants, but they had to be watered. From the sound of it, Mrs. Trent wasn't the type to stick around for that kind of thing. Sarah wasn't sure how she felt about that, or even if she